things I wish everyone knew. A little bit about data center costs. So we did the analysis breakdown, and it looks sort of like this. 45% of the cost on a month-by-month basis of a data center goes into the server. 25% is the power infrastructure. That's the stuff that actually delivers the power to the servers and takes the heat away. 15% is in the power draw. That's what you actually pay the electrical company. And about 15% is the network. And that's both CapEx for the network gear, as well as transit and other kinds of costs. Sadly, this graph has been remarkably stable over time. I mean, for about the 3-4 years I've been watching it, it hasn't changed very much. And honestly, you can recreate sort of the key parts of this, not using any secret numbers that I might have access to. And I encourage everyone to go do that. Servers, go to Fry's. Look at what a server costs. It's about $2,000. If you're going to depreciate it over 3 years, 36 months, that means you're paying about $55 a month for your server. The power draw, call it 240 watts, that's about typical. If you go look up on the government website, you can find 7 cents a kilowatt hour is about the national average for industrial power. That's $12 a month. So, what does this mean and tell us? Well, Amdahl's law is a wonderful thing for focusing the mind. If you're thinking about, I'm going to save electricity, I'm going to turn off servers. Dude, I paid a lot of money for those servers. If you turn them off, they're still depreciating at $55 a month, but they're delivering no value. And you're saving, at most, $12 a month if you left that server turned off for the whole thing. So anytime we have an idea, it's like, okay, I'm gonna shift traffic around, or I'm gonna share load between data centers, make sure that there's always something for the other servers that have the load shifted away from them to be doing. Otherwise, the plan's throwing things away. Reduce network switch usage, reduce the power of network switches. Well, if I have 48 servers per rack, we take about 240 watts per server, and that rack has one top of rack switch, which consumes about 135 watts per switch. If I turned off all of the network infrastructure, I would save about 1/48 of the power draw of the data center. Right? Does this sound like a good idea? And you might say, well, what about all those other switches? There are exponentially more top of rack switches than there are other switches in the data center. So again, Amdahl's law, we need to bring it to everything that we do. But it cuts both ways. Think about reducing the power usage of individual network links. Well, a 10G NIC is gonna cost me about 10 to 20 extra watts per server. And since the size of my data center is really capped by how much power I can deliver to the IT load and take the heat away, that's gonna turn into about 10% fewer servers. Is it worth it or not? The Amdahl's law basically is always be careful to check what you're multiplying each value by. The number of servers in a data center is large. You multiply small values per server, you end up with big changes in the effect of the data center. People have talked a lot about power prices and contracts. I've heard a lot of people say, oh, big data centers have long-term power contracts. No savings are possible, right? Effectively, we've signed a contract to lock in a rate for our data center power. But think about it this way. Contracts are written by actuaries who have the very hard job of effectively trying to predict the weather, because it's the weather that largely determines how much power is going to cost on any particular day. And so if someone's trying to sign a 3-year contract for power, it was put together by actuaries who are trying to predict the average weather over those 3 years. And because they want to be profitable, they had to add quite a bit of margin for profitability. This graph, which I've sadly blinked all the real numbers out of, shows on the blue curve the day-ahead price, how much power you pay for if you tell the power company, here's how much power I want tomorrow. The red curve is the real-time price. If you go to the power company and say, here's how much power I want right now, and the power company can sometimes say no. The really interesting thing about it is the red curve goes less than zero. There are times the power company will pay you to take power away from them and burn it up in your servers so that they don't have to figure out how to discharge it, because storing electrical energy is a really hard problem, which is also worth thinking about. Metrics that I wish everybody thought about. The number one metric for data centers is profit. Don't get confused, it's about anything else. Sadly, profit is equal to revenue minus costs. I am a nerd. The way you increase revenue is you have great ideas about user interfaces or things that people want to do that they're willing to pay money for. I can't help there. But cost is something, as an engineer, I think we can understand, and we can look at how to reduce costs. So how do you reduce costs? Well, one thing you do is you buy cheaper stuff. 45% of the cost of this in the servers, find a way to get cheaper servers. Optimize the components. Smoke them if you got them. Again, those servers are really expensive. Once I bought them, I want them smoking hot. I want to use them. High utilization values are a good thing. That's true for servers. That's true for networks. Find ways to fill troughs. Fill troughs in power usage. Fill troughs in network usage. The final thing I want to say is the mechanical engineers do matter. The 25% of the data center that I cost that I sort of pointed out at the beginning is the cost to deliver power to a server and take the heat away. And so the metric that really does matter is not how many, you know, watts per hour I'm using. It's the dollar per watt delivered and removed from my service. If we can find ways to drive this down, that's actually going to change the needle in terms of cost on data centers. And so, you know, don't get me wrong. It's not that I think that we should be wasting electricity. But the greenness really needs to come here, figuring out how to reduce dollars per watt. How do you want to organize this? Should everyone go and be?
No, we need an academic now, so that we can have balance.
I'm still trying to read my notes from last night at 4 in the morning.
See, that's the great thing about slides. I did the thinking a while ago, and now I don't have to think.
Would a token academic like to stand forth?
Yeah, I'm just
okay. Good.
Solving AV issues.
All right.
Problems with products, you mean?
Okay, so I was asked to do this thing, and I tried to make a really polite excuse, and John thwarted me on it, and so this is the thing. I was asked to talk about what I, as an academic, need to know about clusters. And so the way that I read the request for this thing from John and Jan is basically that their perception is, after reading all these submissions, that there is an academic sort of role, which I will play with Jan, who has questions, right? They're going to make wild suppositions about things. Whoa. And then we have industrial researchers, and they're going to assert facts that will elucidate our work in the space of the cloud. Okay, so there were a bunch of questions. I didn't know the answer to any of them, so it's a good panel, I guess. This is the only one that I thought I might be able to answer. The answer is no. Very good. So VLSI is kind of a weird thing to compare the state of the cloud to. And a lot of people in this room have been working on cloud stuff for long before it was called the cloud. And I think a more comfortable sort of analogy for the cloud is as a utility, right? And let's pick a nice sort of vanilla utility that we can all sort of relate to. Let's talk about water supply. Water starts in a reservoir, and it makes its way eventually to septic treatment. So anybody think there's a lot of innovative stuff happening in water distribution and treatment? Anybody work in this space? Is Google doing anything in here, John? Yeah.
Actually,
there's a street view camera on top. So, okay, so I just want to go through three really quick points, right? This is a dialogue between me as an academic perspective and the good industry panelists that we have, where I think that we have a symbiotic relationship. Right? I need to write papers, and you have all of the toys. And so we need to figure out how we can get along on this thing. And there are three points that I thought we could just discuss. Right? One is how we work together and what we have to offer each other. And so I got into systems research because of this. Right? Systems research is not about achieving perfection. Right? It's about achieving something pretty good most of the time and doing clever stuff in the fringes. And I ended up fortuitously being involved in a project that was effective enough to become a product. And then I learned about this other thing, which is the good is the enemy of the good enough, right? Let's get it out the door. And so what is my point on this first one? So I think I'm pretty good at taking wild guesses as an academic. I like to do crazy things, and I have grad students that don't know when one of my ideas is probably really bad. And sometimes good things come out of that. Operations people are really good at taking these risks too, as long as the risks are completed by the end of the quarter on budget. Right? So I'm good at looking forward sometimes, and you're good at looking backwards. And the best you can do is try and give me some hints. Right? Treat me as a random sort of state space exploration and give me some constraints that I can set in my introductions, because that's the stuff that I really like industry for. All right, problem two. Why should I believe you? Right? Assuming that you can give me these introduction fodder problems and facts, why on earth should I believe that you, industry people, have anything to say that I can actually count on? Do you know what's going on inside your data set? Does anybody in the room work for Sony? They don't, I'm pretty sure. Does anybody know what an availability zone is? I thought I did, but I don't think I do. You know, the it didn't work out so well for Amazon in April around this, and so they, you know, adjust the abstraction, and maybe really if you want availability, you should be going across data centers because there are a few shared things in there. So my point again, because I may take a while in getting to it, the more you disclose about how your systems work, the better we can do improving them, especially since we don't have access to them. And I think if you read the text of Amazon's disclosure, because this is a really, really interesting thing from the cloud, they learned a lot, I think, from explaining to their customers why they lost service for a week. And I think that that kind of disclosure, source and operational experience, is the kind of thing that can lead to a lot of useful research, right? That I can take weird ideas off of. Okay, last point. Sooner or later, this isn't going to be so hot. Right? Enjoy this rendition of Hot Cloud. I'm going to keep smiling as I say really nasty things. So I have a quote here from Google's ex-lead of the Wave project. That's a great position to have held, Danji Prasanna. And Danji, in the end of this blog, explaining why he left Wave immediately after receiving his yearly bonus from Google, takes a bit of a potshot at Google and says, actually, all this supercomputer bumper sticker these Googlers have on their notebooks, it's not that great. MapReduce is pretty cheesy these days. Hadoop's better. You should be using jQuery and MondoDB. That's awesome. So I've seen this from the industrial side, too, working for the 6 years at ZenSource and Citrix. And I like cowboys, too. The problem is, sooner or later, you need stuff to still work while you're changing it. And I think what that means is as soon as anybody depends on the stuff you've built, you're screwed. Right? So these things are going to get pretty boring to work on as we can't change them effectively because they're not new anymore. So again, there's a symbiosis around us working together. Right? Everybody that's working for Google, recently switching from academic jobs to Google, I think we're ahead of an inflection point. And UBC is hiring this fall. So if you want to... Okay, so when I sat down to write this talk, I was going to lament something that all the OS people at SOSP were doing in the late 90s and early 2000s. Windows screwed systems research, right? It's closed. I don't know about how it's failing. I don't know how they're doing anything. Where are the problems? How am I going to get my crap published and end anywhere impactful? And I thought, here we go again. The cloud has ruined this great space of innovation. And as I think about it, I think that's not true. I think the industrial practitioners are much more screwed than I am as an academic, because you have to make money. So I think that we really need to spend some time thinking about how we can work together to keep innovating on this thing, how we can build these systems to actually change in interesting ways. And I think one of the key things there is you should go and talk to your lawyers and understand how much stuff you really, really need to keep inside your walls. Or don't ask them. Just tell us everything. I like that plan better, too. So I'm done. Thanks.
And John said it was okay to tell us.
So can I steal your dongle? I said I'm going to put up a slide.
Yes. Yeah, sure. You guys suck.
I'm putting up the slide mostly to make Greg feel bad because he didn't make slides.
We can find the chalkboard for you, Greg, if you'd like.
And this isn't really a slide. This is actually a table in my rough notes. And I just bring it up because you mentioned money. And so we've got money. As a matter of fact, if you looked at the largest companies that are out there, it's really easy to figure out how much money companies have spent on their data centers to a first-order magnitude. You look on their balance sheets at their property and equipment number. And you'll see that Apple has about $6 billion in office buildings and data centers. Amazon has $2.4 billion. Microsoft has $8 billion. They might have more office buildings than computers. I don't know. Same with Google. American Express does a lot of computation. Maybe they have big data centers. I like this one down here. Walmart's often touted as doing huge data mining operations. Does anyone know how much money Walmart spent on data centers? It looks like they could spend a lot of money on data centers. And the funny thing is, we're all building the same crap. We've got piles of computers in a rack hooked up to a rack switch, hooked up to a central core switch with bandwidth limitations, with who knows whatever, pick a number of the day, how many CPUs are you going to put in there, how much RAM, how much disk. And how do we decide on these numbers, how much bandwidth to put here, how much RAM to put there? Well, what we do is we look at what we built last time. We said, wow, this one hurts. And then we spend more money on that. and we buy more. Is there a concrete methodology to how many disks you need in a disk array? I was there once when we were trying to decide for a web search cluster. We're designing the next generation web search indexing system, which has now been published. It's called Percolator, is the back-end database for this. We're trying to decide, how many drives do we need to store this database? And we looked at the size of it, and we're like, oh, well, we need at least, you know, so many petabytes a disk and whatever. And then we're like, oh, crap, we're going to be seat constrained. Well, if we get 48,000 drives, that's about right. So we build a 48,000 drive storage array simply because it was big enough. And we figured if we didn't use it all for this database, we'd find other work that would use it in the, on the side. And so we have no methodology, I would argue, other than incrementalism. And that is where industry is going to get screwed, is because we're too conservative. We don't, we can't afford, literally, to take a giant risk when it comes to data center design because our data centers are too big to fail. Now, let's compare this to VLSI, because we've been asked to compare this to VLSI. Roughly in the mid-80s, academia hit the exact same spot. Used to be you could get a double EPHD by coming up with some crazy idea for a CPU, designing a CPU, having it fabbed, testing it. It either worked or it failed, and then you wrote up a nice PhD dissertation about the success or the failure of your CPU. And it was great until the number of transistors on a chip, the cost of fabbing and the latency of fabbing got so high that academia could no longer afford to tell a PhD student, you need to stick around for 27 years until the thing is done. So what did they do? Well, industry had the same problem at the time. The latency between idea and implementation and the cost between those two, the gap got too large for it to be feasible to take risks. So things got a little bit more conservative in terms of designs. And also, they spent a lot of effort on trying to figure out how the heck do we model and simulate this. And so I'm going to advance a simple thesis, which is for cluster, cloud, data center, warehouse, whatever kind of computing to succeed, we need to come up with a methodology for modeling workloads and simulating them so that we can evaluate different designs and figure out whether they make any sense or not. And so let me type in my password because we're super secure here. To get it right. So I've got, basically, all I wanted to ask is a series of questions. If we could model crazy, wild, unusual data center designs. What? I've just got a document here. What kind of questions could we answer? Well, we can answer things like, well, what is the right layout for a data center? Do we want a sea of uniform computers? Does non-uniformity in a data center provide an opportunity, not only in that we can upgrade a section of the data center at a time, but also so we can, you know, have different workloads on customized machines that fit them rather well? We have a huge problem at Google with internal fragmentation. You've got a job that needs lots of CPU and not much RAM. You've got another job that needs lots of RAM and not much CPU, and you can't really fit them on the same machine because of the granularity of machines that you happen to have built this week. How many machines belong in a cluster? If, let's say, you had a Walmart-sized budget and you could build an infinitely large cluster for some value of infinity, how many machines would you put in a cluster, and when would you say, that's enough, stop, let's start building a second cluster? I don't know the answer to that. I know that inside Google, we're currently arguing that we've chosen a number that's too small and maybe we can go bigger. I talk to my friends at Microsoft, and they say, we think we've chosen a number that's too big, and we think we're going to go smaller. Neither of us know what the other person's numbers are. And so it would be really cool if we had at least a theoretical basis for what the right size of a cluster is. And related to that is, how reliable can you make a cluster? How many nines is it possible to tack on to the reliability of your web service? Is 99.9% achievable? Sure, we do it every day. How about with 8 nines? What would it take to get there? Can we build a service that's that reliable? Because there are certain things which you really want more reliability. What else do I have in here? How big? Should we make clusters out of clusters? Do we want hierarchy? Can we create a mega cluster that spans all of planet Earth or the entire solar system? I don't know. It'd be really cool if we could build it. What belongs in hardware? What belongs in software? Does encryption belong in hardware and software? Data compression, hardware or software? Across, when you get to cluster scales, you can actually start making reasonable trade-offs about these things and asking these questions and a lot of the time we just don't know what the right answer is. How do you do security isolation in clusters? If you make a really big cluster, eventually you make a cluster that takes the entire computing universe and puts it in one single building on one single network. How do we make it so that those people don't get into little international wars with each other over the bits on the network? It's, you know, just bad news. At what scale does it make sense to optimize for the cluster's time versus the software engineer's time? One thing I've noticed at Google is it's really, really easy to take any arbitrary problem and say, yeah, you know what could solve this problem? MapReduce. MapReduce is a great, great hammer that people use for driving in the coolest screws ever. And so there is a point at which it makes a lot of sense to not use a hammer to drive in screws, and there is a point at which it makes a lot of sense to use a hammer to drive in screws. It depends on the scale of the problem that you're trying to solve. How do we characterize these workloads? If we're going to simulate these things, we need to have some sort of methodology of characterizing them, and all we know is that everything we've tried doesn't work so well. How do we properly isolate jobs on machines? We're talking about this. How do we avoid stranded resources? Here's one which I love. How many people have seen a talk where the answer to, oh, we've got extra resources, we need something to do with it, let's just run more batch work? There isn't enough batch work to run on all the machines we have. Maybe other companies are lucky in that they've got an infinite, unbounded supply of batch work that's ready to run that happens to have terabytes or petabytes of data co-located with where the program needs to run now that they can just run on demand. But I don't personally live in that universe, and so just run more batch work isn't always a good solution to soaking up computation resources. Same with powering machines off. Powering machines off, if you're going to power a machine off, you might as well just sell it on eBay, because you had one too many machines. Am I out of time? I'm down close to the bottom of my list. And here's one other question which I've always wondered, which is, if you build just an arbitrarily complex, convoluted, and twisted cluster, and you hire smart software engineers, can they figure out how to optimize for it? Because my experience is they could optimize for virtually anything, and then you've got to go in later on, and when you simplify the cluster, undo all of their optimizations, which is actually much harder than creating them in the first place. So there's this horrible feedback loop, which is the same feedback loop that I would argue the VLSI industry got into, which is, for the longest time in VLSI, and I would argue this is probably true today, and the folks from Intel can tell me I'm wrong, is you build a CPU that makes last year's spec go faster, and then next year's spec comes out and makes your new CPU look slow again, and you repeat. Well, if we characterize today's workloads to build tomorrow's clusters, we might be building the wrong clusters. And I have no idea how we can possibly break that treadmill. I'm sure Intel would love to, you know, give you lots of money if you had a good answer for that in the VLSI world. And that's all I got in terms of RAM. So I leave it to Greg to clean up.
Can I borrow your dog?
For the record, the guidance we got said two things. 4 minutes. And we prefer no slides. Anyway,
Greg, is it true that you're the elder statesman here?
Yeah, so as I looked at the panelist, actually, I was a little bit torqued to find out that I was the old guy. Yeah, and I will get you back, John, yeah, at some point. Yeah, but I figured as long as I'm that, I should, you know, run with that and play the curmudgeon-y role a little bit, right? And unfortunately, you were the wrong shill for me. You were the perfect one. So pretend Dave went just before me. Now, before I do my curmudgeonly thing, I want to say that Andy and Chris are 100% right, and it's actually really, really important that we're communicating with industry and getting from them feedback on things. I've made all kinds of really bad assumptions over the years, and many of them didn't make it to submitted papers that had to get reviewed and knocked off because we told our industry friends about it. They told us about the stupid assumptions before we got that far, right? It's incredibly valuable, very important. But with that said, I'm back to being the old guy, right? So let's not pretend that these people that have industry names on their badges somehow actually know everything because they're at a company where it's possible to know those things because of access. It's not always the case that when they tell you assumption X is wrong or assumption X is right, that that's true. I mean, it's certainly not always the case that it's true generally, right? So when you engage in those conversations with people, it has to go beyond the assumption X is wrong, right? Why is it wrong? Can you explain to me, you know, what led you to believe that it's wrong? Is it something that's specific to your environment that maybe doesn't generalize to all of the other things, right? And just for fun, we'll do a couple of examples. So my first example of this relates to networking. And a few years ago, we did some work on a phenomenon called Incast, where multiple senders to a single destination, as you might get with a striped file read in distributed storage, could cause you to dramatically underutilize the link and get like 1/10 of the good put out of the network that you ought to get. Okay, and we measured the phenomenon and you know showed it across a bunch of different networks and talked to a variety of people who thought it was great. But there was one really big company that had all kinds of giant data centers and they told us we were wrong. It doesn't happen in their environments. It's not a big deal. It's not significant. Fast forward a few years, and the follow-on work that sort of seems most interesting going on in Incast is coming from that exact same big company, motivated by their internal observations of what an important problem it is in their data centers. And I just find that interesting, right? Either the data centers did change dramatically over the course of a few years, or it was there and maybe not being noticed for what it was, right? We never did figure out which way that question went, but I find that to be an interesting case study. I'll give you one more, and then I'll shut up and sit down, because I'm trying to stay close to my 4 minutes. In the late 90s, right, and this is a curmudgeon, I get to do the old curmudgeon thing, right? Back in the used to was, when I and a bunch of my students were trying to figure out a new direction to go with our research, a big new systems project we could do, we observed as we were sort of amping ourselves up over the course of a number of years and asking our industry friends what we should work on, that there was a pretty consistent push for us to work on storage management, especially at large scales. And we'd hear this over and over from them when we asked them for feedback. And whenever they would tell us that, we would turn around and say, great, that sounds intriguing, but I'm not sure exactly what you mean when you say that. Can you tell me what the problem with storage management is? No. But it's really important. Right? This went on for a number of years, and we finally decided, okay, well, we have to do something because we can't keep like ignoring the input from people we keep asking for input, or otherwise they're going to stop answering us even if they're not willing to tell us what the answer means. So we went around and talked to people who run data centers, some big internet services, banks, universities, anybody that would talk to us about what their problems are, and said, okay, well, is storage management a big problem for you? Answer was always yes. So can you tell me what the problem is? No. But I'm really busy, right? So even the people that were actually doing it on the ground couldn't tell you what it was. Sadly, one of our industry friends, towards the end of our attempt to get other people to tell us what it was, finally responded, tired of hearing probably the question from us, we were kind of hoping you would figure out what it is and then solve it. So anyway, I agree that we have to be talking back and forth, but we have to be questioning as academics, not just taking what we hear from them as fact and stopping at that point. That's my position.
So first of all, thank you to all of these people. There's a reason we picked this set. So now what we want to do is just throw it open to questions from the floor, because the alternative is to hear them rant at each other, and really I would like to get them some guidance, because it's clear they need it. So what to talk about. Please.
nobody wants to know anything from these people.
Do people think it's wood?
That's what the microphones are telling us, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, while you're all building up the courage to go to the thing, I know some students who would love to take advantage of some idle resources with their batch work. Yeah. You know, if that was.
So remember those security issues I brought up? have you solved those yet?
That's my problem?
What? Isn't that industry's job, is to give you the problems?
Well, he said that.
Oh. Well, I mean, a really interesting thing, sort of to that end, is that you would think, okay, I run infrastructure for Bing. We all work for Microsoft. We're all on the same team. We don't need security from each other. We don't need performance isolation from each other. Wrong. Because even inside the same company, you know, one feature team, we have our deliverables. We have to meet our goals. Do things to make life hard for other people. So yes, if we build our stuff right, we probably can take on your students' batch work, because otherwise I want to get paid by the power company for using our electricity.
Yeah, we would love to have the ability to run your batch work. One of the biggest issues, not the security issue, that's just an easy thing to throw and say, oh, this is an obvious issue. One of the biggest issues is that we found that when we run an unknown arbitrary workload on the same machine as the stuff which is serving Google.com, sometimes it has negative consequences. There are interactions between multiple jobs that run on machines, and that's actually one of our hardest open research problems, is how do we properly isolate between jobs and make it so that if we accept a random, arbitrary, low priority job, it doesn't totally hose our high priority, low latency serving workload on the same machine.
Is he leaving the room or going to the mic?
Candy. So this is Mike Kozich from Intel, and this is a question mostly to the industry folks. Could you comment a little bit on how academics should think about scale? So if you want to show something about scale, you know, are there diminishing returns as you get larger and to larger and larger scales in terms of what changes? And then, as a corollary, what would be sort of a minimum size experiment that becomes interesting, and in what domains?
Well, okay, the first thing, I want to echo what Chris said, which is that there are definite problems with internal fragmentation. And you want to make your pool of server resources big enough to leverage all the economies of scale that you can get, and no more. Because any more servers than that you put into that same pool is just sort of, you know, putting more capacity at risk as part of a single cluster, because each cluster somehow ends up being a point of failure. And I also have no idea how to pick the point at which we will maximize the economies of scale for, you know, the workloads we have now, never mind the ones that we're going to get in the future. So to some extent, I can't tell you how big is big enough. I mean, I can tell you 1,000 is too small. 1,000,000 is probably too big. But honestly, I think that's something where it's a very much an open problem to figure out.
So one of the things I found that as you scale up, the average case behavior usually holds constant. It's really easy to report average case behavior. What gets really freaky and unusual, and it's the most frankly interesting to me, is the long tail unusual behavior which starts emerging. You will get the one machine in your cluster whose real-time clock isn't. And so if you have a time-based protocol for synchronization that, say, is based on MTP across your cluster, all of a sudden you'll have the one machine that decides it's tomorrow instead of today, and it will win all elections or something like that. You will, hard drives will start corrupting your data. That's more and more well-known. They'll just give you the wrong answer back. You'll hit... My favorite bug ever was the day I finally figured out, after 2 months of hunting down a problem, that I was driving machines out of ephemeral ports and just completely exhausting their ephemeral ports and causing sections of our network code to just fall over in strange ways, because I had one MapReduce worker that was talking to over 20,000 other MapReduce workers, and if you do that in a striding access pattern, it causes all the ports to go away. So it's the unusual behaviors that suddenly become the there's no way you can avoid them behaviors that are the really hard things to avoid.
And actually, that's the thing that worries me about your idea of trying to simulate and model, because again, the simulate and model, you simulate and model the things you expect to see, and it's these gotchas, these corner cases, like, oh, I never realized that X was correlated with Y, that ends up cropping up when you actually build it. So, I mean, we see that problem with testing versus production. We do extensive testing before we release stuff into production. We make our test labs as close to production as we possibly can. And we regularly have problems where there's just something in production that's different. And so our response to that has been trying to figure out how can we do test in production? I mean, how can we take random new stuff, roll it out in the production data centers, and still manage to survive somehow if and when it blows up?
So I'm going to play devil's advocate, because I'm not sure how much I actually believe this, we should build simulators methodology. But the same thing happened in the VLSI industry. The first simulators were not accurate. They got validated once, you know, you built what you simulated, and you discovered, hey, the simulation was off by an order of magnitude, but now we've learned how to fix it in this respect. And so the only way to solve that problem is to iterate.
All right, but I'm going to stick up for the academics here for a second. So Mike asked you a question, and you both artfully dodged it. Yeah, the simulation got a little bit closer to it, but he asked you about what kind of scale do we have to try to play at before you're going to listen to anything we say.
It depends on
and
the problem you're trying to solve.
And you gave numbers where there was an upper and a lower bound that are both beyond what we're going to have access to. So what do we do?
Collaborate.
So we'll go with the idea of we're going to test in live in your environments by collaborating with you. We'll, you know, take some grad students and we'll go to town.
At
Bing, right? I mean, Google wasn't willing to commit to that, but Bing is looking for testing live, right?
I guess I'm pointing out it's a problem that confronts us even in industry. We have exactly that same problem. You know, I want to test a new network architecture. Well, there's the amount of money I can justify having around in a test lab. And then at some point, you have to decide to commit to it. And even then, you have to figure out how you can commit to it in a way that if it blows up, you can back out.
So a few years ago, I wanted to test the scalability limits of MapReduce. I wanted to answer the question of at what point does MapReduce fall over, because I want to get the MapReduce team working on fixing that internally. So I said, okay, well, let's benchmark it. Let's run petabyte sort. And everyone, like, looks at me dumbfounded, because a few years ago, a petabyte was a big number to run a single program on. And I'm like, but wait, we're turning up this new cluster over here. It's got these 48,000 drives, and all this. So we have a petabyte of storage. So let's just go and use this as a burn-in test. And because I happen to know the right people, and I managed to bribe them with the right alcoholic beverages, I managed to get, you know, this cluster for a couple weeks so I could run petabyte sort. And that's how it got done. Is there a formal experimentation and test process to do an experiment at that scale? No, because who's going to give you millions of dollars of hardware just to play with? Unless, you know, you make some friends and you...
So let me pose a question to the academics. Why aren't you collaborating like the physicists do?
How do the physicists...
Yeah, what do you mean by that?
Things like high-energy physics does massive single or two worldwide experiments. They pool their resources. They get to the scale and the giga-electron volts that you could never do in your backyard. Or perhaps a more useful question is, what could you do to collaborate better amongst yourselves?
Yeah, so physics, wow, I mean, that's a big distance from where we are community-wise, right? And I don't mean in terms of collaboration. We do collaborate, but the physicists that, at least the ones I imagine you're talking about with the experiments that take, you know, 20 years to get to the answer, sort of are stuck. They don't have a choice. And they have entire generations of students that do nothing but work on constructing the mechanism that will one day allow an experiment to be run, whose results they hope to be around to see, right? And whose results they hope actually get seen because the funding doesn't die off after 10 years, right? That's it's an interesting question, but man, that's a tough sell for our community to make that kind of a sea change in the way things work, right? Yeah.
But the nice thing about computers is they're much more coalescible than parts of telescopes or Large Hadron Colliders, right?
Well, if you're asking why don't we pool sets of machines here and sets of machines there, I think we have done that in some cases, right? So Planet Lab is an example of exactly that. Slowly that sort of thing is happening a little bit with cloud computing. There's an open Cirrus thing where you can't actually
use slowly is the operative word.
Well, these things are always slow, right? And physicists take 20 years. That was the example you used. So we're doing pretty good, actually. I don't have an easy answer for that one, but
the other problem that academics face that is truly hard is that you need to have an application. You need to have users, you need to have people who care about the service you're offering, who will come give you traffic, who will berate you when your latency is too long, and give you honest feedback on how it's doing. Because honestly, it's that feedback that drives a lot of where we invest in making improvements. I mean, if Bing were just the big computational engine in the cloud, there'd be no, we wouldn't know where to focus our energy on what to make better.
You've been very patient.
I have a musing. So it seems like there's been a lot of discussion about scale around cloud computing. I think as academics, we like things that are really big and are just like pathologically hard. People got really into the P2P thing. Let's assume that no one is trusted. How do we make a thing with a billion nodes and it's, you know, resistant to Sybil attacks? And you know, and you just go to town on that for a few years and get a lot of PhDs. I think that from my perspective at VMware, cloud computing is primarily not about scale. It's right, like most big enterprises, which are the people who kind of consistently deliver money and do a lot of cool, valuable things. I mean, the consumer space is great too, but we love these people. Right, they really, their relational databases work really well. Like, you know, they don't need big table and all this madness. But there is this problem of how do we give them this collection of machines and, you know, give them data services and give them applications and make this thing so that it will basically run itself, right? It's how do we eliminate IT? How do we eliminate ops? And so recently I've been working on Cloud Foundry, right, which is we're now in the providing a service to consumers and everyone else. And one of the biggest problems we have is how do we find good ops people? And the solution to this doesn't seem to be to find good ops people. It's just to get rid of the ops people. And it seems to me that the problem in academia to addressing these questions, I guess, is twofold. One of what you're speaking to is you need applications and customers in order to find out all the weird, goofy things that actually make it difficult to leave it in the corner and just leave it alone, which I think is the holy grail, really, for the cloud. It's that we have this collection of hardware, and we have the people who want, you know, the real estate application that matches the realtor with the houses, and then that whole IT department, like, those guys, I don't know, they go back to community college and they learn to be nurses or something, and whatever one does once the IT people get removed. So that's the problem I care about, or a problem that I care about, and I'm not sure, you know, as a culture, as researchers, how to get traction around that. I mean, I remember system administration seemed really interesting when I was an undergrad at Berkeley a million years ago, and we had Millennium and all this, and it was like, well, how do you measure it? How do you write papers about it? And still, it seems like, in terms of methodology and kind of standards for rigor and whatnot, it's very hard for us as a community to make traction on these things. So I'd love to hear what you guys have to say.
So you claim that you want to automate system administration, and you also claim that you don't necessarily care about scale as a first class thing. And I would argue that the reason you want to automate system administration is because you've reached a scale where it's more profitable to create a robot than it is to buy more people to do some of the tasks that you want to get done. And so in an academic environment, let's assume you had a room and you put a bunch of computers in it and some broke. Well, you can send a grad student in to fix it. Like, you know, the rate at which they break is not faster than the rate at which you hire new grad students, right? They're relatively reliable. And so, but once you have 10,000 computers that are rogue and the same number of grad students, your grad students will hate you if they spend all their days walking up and down the aisles, ripping off machines, replacing hard drives, putting the machines back, and so on, because they won't be able to get any work done. And then they'll want to automate everything they do. That is very important. It's also very hard to figure out how to automate things going wrong, because in order for things to go wrong, you have to have enough machines sitting there to encounter all the things going wrong. It's the long tail problem once again.
Are you sure that I mean, to Tal's point, are you sure that you guys are talking about the same kind of system that Tal and all the people that presented papers this morning are talking about?
I'm pretty sure that we're talking about a different kind. There's sort of the enterprise consolidation,
right.
And then there's the scale-out application.
Right. I mean, you've both different. Independently said, don't really have a lot of heterogeneity, would love to be able to have other people do stuff, but too bad them.
Well, right. And to your point, I actually think that it's much easier for academics to do research in that sort of enterprise automation consolidation space than it is in the sort of cloud scale, effectively supercomputing space that we're talking about here. Now, granted, I think as a research agenda, it's hard to do it for exactly the reasons that you describe. You know, exactly what are the metrics? You know, how do I get the input data? And I actually think that there have been a lot of efforts to try and do that. I mean, there's the Hot ICE workshop, which used to be called INM Internet Network Management. Now it's Internet Cloud and Enterprise Management, LISA, Large Integrations Systems Administration. So there are academic communities around that. But
totally, you won't get tenure submitting to LISA, but that's cool.
Yeah. So.
Not at a top school.
Sorry?
It's like you won't get tenure submitting to LISA, not at a top school.
I agree. I think that's...
To speak to the cultural issue.
I think there is a really cultural issue. And I think it's something that we do have to, like I say, work carefully to define... what are the metrics we're trying to optimize and get some realization that there's, if anything, the long tail of most data center automation, data center tasks, is in this corporate IT enterprise consolidation size space rather than the supercomputer space. Although the supercomputer space is super cool, and I love working there, having worked in both.
Okay, I'm sorry. I've got to challenge this issue of nobody's working on automation and you can't get tenure doing stuff in automation and stuff like that, because it's just not so. I haven't counted recently, but I can't remember the last OSDI, SOSP, NSDI that I saw that didn't have at least two tracks on work that I would say is related directly to automation, right? A lot of it is focused on problems of problem diagnosis, because we've all sort of poked some at the automation question. I sort of joked about this some, but I was serious, right? There's been a lot of people that have been working on self-management of various kinds. There are conferences that are more academic than LISA is, like the Autonomic Computing Conference, ICAC. But there's a lot of papers that are happening at our top venues as well, and a lot of them have picked problem diagnosis as a focus, because it seems to be sort of the hardest one to deal with, because it's the most variable and it's the one that requires combining the most different things, and there's no question that's hard to evaluate, but there's a lot of work that's been going on in the space of trying to reduce administration costs. It is a first-class thing that people worry about. Now, one of the things that Dave said that I thought was interesting, he made the comment that it might actually be easier for us to work on enterprise consolidation things. And that's always, I was surprised to hear that. And I guess maybe it's easier in that it's actually not impossible for us to get physical infrastructure
to do it.
The visibility of the academics into the workloads of that kind of an environment is basically nil, and has been for as long as I've played the game as an academic. And I don't know how to fix that.
Right? You're welcome to send us your grad students, because we have plenty of things where we're like, wow, we're really interested in what happens in the field. And we have product managers who make stuff up. And but it's like, where do you get the time? Because, you know, we have other things on our plate, and we do. And I mean, to take, you know, like a summer to go off and measure like what's going on at Credit Suisse in terms of resource management stuff or high availability stuff, that would be awesome.
That's a great idea. Hypothetically speaking, I'll send two of my students a month ago to VMware to work with the team that does data analysis collection data. Yeah. Yeah, two data's in there, but yeah, just hypothetically.
But next summer, man, you're more than welcome.
But I also just have to joke, right? So I was shocked to hear a person from a company say that yeah, they want to automate things to get rid of the IT people. Yeah, that was one of the things that I got told very early on in focusing on the self-management stuff. I was never to say out loud in front of anybody, it's not about getting rid of the IT people. See, it's about enabling them to do more.
No, you just mustn't sell the IT.
We are the guy who advocated to buy our product. We want to enable him to take everyone else's job and funnel their salary to him, which will cause him to buy more of our stuff.
There you go, a positive way to make it work.
Yeah.
So arguably, in our environment, we only have so many, I wouldn't call them IT people, operational staff. And we found that we're bottlenecked in the number of machines that we can build by the number of operational staff who we can hire who are able to learn fast enough how to understand the giant behemoth that we've created.
Okay, come on. You guys cheat so bad on the counts of who you call operational staff that I can't even stand it, right?
But
you have reams of PhDs who have pagers because they are effectively part of your operational staff.
And they don't,
and you don't
like
count them.
The
you don't
pagers.
Count the other people.
Exactly.
Right?
They don't like the pagers. So
well,
instead,
I don't care if they don't like it. You can't not count them just because they don't like the job that they have.
Well, no. What I mean is that because we can't increase the number of times per day their pagers ring without them going, damn it, I quit. I didn't want to be an operational person after getting this PhD. We instead have to find ways of making it so that we can build more computers without ringing their pagers frequently that effectively manage themselves. So that provides an internal pressure to automate the management of our machines.
I mean, the reason to give the pagers to the PhDs is so that they see what the live side issues are, with the hope that then they still have enough time and mental bandwidth that then they can write the software to automate it so that the pager doesn't go off. And you're right, there's this very slippery slope. You need to apply pain to the PhDs so that they produce good results and not apply so much pain that they have no time to think and they run away screaming.
I love the dodges, right? I mean, this is just beautiful, right? So they started with, we have a very limited operational staff. They said, that's BS. And then they started talking about how important it was people are effectively part of the operational staff, right?
Number of machines to number of operational staff, no matter how you count it, even if you include every single person in the company, it's still a giant ratio that we need to make bigger.
Only the one set is our pressure.
Differ on some of the comments because I work at VMware also. So just be aware that there are differences of opinion within each of the companies, whether they're open source or commercial. So
of course.
Just want to make sure you understand that everyone's opinion.
sorry. You don't want to get rid of the IT staff? Is that what you're trying to say?
No.
See, that's somebody who got the marketing memo on how to describe.
Let me put make this to make it crystal clear. If any of you can pass our SRE interview process, we will hire you.
Did you just call me dumb?
No. You failed to apply.
Impatient, probably.
No. We would love to be able to hire more operational staff. We
To build computers. Is just closing up, right?
Next question.
But I think the underlying question is the right one, right? Is this question of large systems versus small systems, and the small systems end up benefiting from the automation and the simplification that you do in the large systems because you absolutely have to, there is no other way, end up indirectly benefiting the small systems, right? And that's how it flows down to the everyday CIO and IT staff.
Hold on, right?
And so that's why the whole thing works. For everyone. Sorry.
So Eric has just explained IT Ponzi, I think. So I want to clarify this a little bit more. So we've established there's this supercomputing bent. So let's just dismiss all that stuff, right? You guys are experts at building supercomputing, you know, single app stacks. But because of that expertise and the fact that you have ops people with PhDs, how much internally are you guys using the same data center resources to do the sort of heterogeneous multiplexing that the papers that we've been seeing here today are on? How much does that happen in your environments?
Quite a bit, I would say, because there's a lot that needs to go on to make something that looks, Google, Bing might look like a single application.
Right.
But when you start unwrapping it, there are, like I said, there are a lot of services, there are a lot of feature teams
Yep.
that are all focused on their particular part. And they do orchestrate to create this overall thing. But they're very heterogeneous in their architecture, their layout, their resource demands. So
saying you've got APIs analogous to EC2 or whatever that you can book against to get a bunch of VMs for you.
You have to do things. I mean, that's the workload we need to support.
We've got external APIs that do that kind of thing, like App Engine, which people can do. We've got internal versions of that, and like huge portions of our HR stack is run on top of that. So we've got, you know, internal finance apps, internal HR apps, internal performance review stuff, internal games, which people set up because they have some free time, and it's as well as the thousands of applications written by different teams that have to run in our clusters in order to create products that you see. Like, you know, search is contacting lots and lots of different services behind the cover. So is Maps, so is Reader, so is all the stuff that we produce.
One last quick question, Michael.
No, sure. I just found, I think, one of the most amusing parts of the entire discussion is hearing academics suggest that maybe they could take advantage of your great compute resources, and the hesitation, the conservative approach of worrying that you know, the electric meter that they're going to plug into your power grid is going to somehow take the whole grid down. I just found that particular side of this kind of amazing as we're all trying to promote the appropriate use of cloud computing. So appreciate that.
Okay, so I think I'm going to say thank you to our panelists. Great job, guys. I'll repeat some advice I gave at Hotos, and I would encourage you guys to do the same. If you're an academic or a student, go find an industry person and say, tell me about a problem. And don't go away until you understand the problem well enough that you can repeat it back to the industry person. If you're an industry person, find a student and say, let me tell you about an interesting problem we have, because we have better problems than you do. And don't go away until the student or the academic can say, I understand your problem, can repeat it back to you. Go, have fun. We'll be back at 2:30.